compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analysed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook. Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation. Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, well, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but that's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, the shake-up that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example, wheat and rice. But that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit. And also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peat, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you, especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Now for our final portion of the programme, let's check out some news and trends in the food and agriculture industries and some of its related trades. Each year, millions of tons of food go to waste. That's awful. Now a United Nations report shows that Iranians have the lowest food waste per capita in the West Asian region.
The report was put together by the Food Waste Index from the UN's Environment Programme. It shows that regardless of income, every Iranian throws away an average of 70 kilograms of food per year. This is below the global average set at nearly 80 kilograms. Food is mainly wasted in three areas: homes, food services, and retail. Household food waste accounted for the highest at 60% of this total.
The agriculture sector is shifting towards technology to realize a new generation of agriculture in the country. Iranian knowledge-based companies have developed dozens of technological products in this field.
The Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology says some 120 technologies have already been produced by 30 knowledge-based companies. These items are now being integrated into the industry. The products cover everything from cultivation to harvest and sales of crops and play an essential role in the productivity and sustainability of crops.
Agriculture is one of the fields in which nanotechnology has been able to develop. Over 50 widely used nano products have been launched in this sector this year alone.
The potential of nanotechnology in agriculture is high. Over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in the country are actively manufacturing a wide range of domestically needed products. Roughly 260 companies of this total are active in agriculture, biotechnology, and the food industry.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Northern Ireland elections, Sinn Féin has become the largest party in local government. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Sinn Féin has become the biggest political party in Northern Ireland local government after stunning gains in council elections. It swept past the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, and became the first nationalist party to hold the most council seats, delivering a political and psychological blow to unionism. Sinn Féin made unprecedented breakthroughs in parts of County Down and County Antrim and almost doubled its vote from the 2019 local elections in Balmoral, Belfast's most affluent ward. with 456 of 462 seats spanning 11 councils declared on Saturday night, Sinn Féin had 143 seats, up from 105. And the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, remained at 122. The non-aligned alliance had 65, a gain of 14, while the moderate Ulster Unionist Party, the UUP, and moderate Nationalist Social Democratic and Labour Party, the SDLP, slumped respectively to 4th and 5th place. The share of the first preference votes underlined the dominance of Sinn Féin, which won 30.9% versus 23.3% for the Democratic Unionist Party, 13.3% for the Alliance, and 10.9% for the Ulster Unionist Party, and 8.7% for the Social Democratic and Labour Party, the SDLP. Nationalist parties won 19,000 more first preference votes than Unionist parties, according to Nicholas White, a sophologist with the consultancy APCO Worldwide. The election was also notable for Lillian Sinoy Barr, an SDLP candidate in Derry, becoming the first black person to be elected as a politician in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin tapped nationalist resentment at a DUP boycott of power-sharing that has blocked Sinn Féin's deputy leader, Michelle O'Neill, from becoming Northern Ireland's first minister. Michelle O'Neill fronted a presidential-style campaign that enticed SDLP voters to back Sinn Féin, which was an IRA mouthpiece during the Troubles. These election results are a positive endorsement of Sinn Féin's message that workers, families and communities need to be supported, and that the blocking of a new assembly by one party must end now, said Michelle O'Neill, who was mobbed by cheering supporters. The DUP leader, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, became a recruiting sergeant for the Republicans, Suzanne Breen, a commentator, wrote in the Belfast Telegraph. The longer Michelle O'Neill is blocked from becoming Northern Ireland's First Minister, the more voters are driven into the arms of her party. Sinn Féin's triumph consolidated its success in last year's Assembly elections, when it eclipsed the DUP as the biggest party in Northern Ireland, and presented unionism with another reminder of its shriveling demographic and political position. For unionism, it's perhaps a wake-up call and smell-the-coffee moment, Edwin Poots, a former DUP leader, told the BBC. Edwin Poots said, "The results showed the need for greater unity among unionists who split their vote between the DUP, the Ulster Unionist Party, and a traditional unionist voice, the TUV. Analysts said the result raised deeper, more troubling questions for those who favour keeping Northern Ireland in the United Kingdom. The Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, emerged intact from what was a proxy referendum on its decision to paralyse the Stormont executive and assembly to protest post-Brexit trading arrangements. While this herded nationalists to Sinn Féin, it also consolidated the DUP as unionism's dominant force. The moderate Ulster Unionist Party and the hard-line, traditional unionist voice were squeezed, letting Donaldson claim vindiction for the DUP policy of claiming credit for the Windsor Framework, which tweaked the original Northern Ireland Protocol, and demanding further concessions before restoring the Good Friday Agreement institutions. There is speculation that the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, will do so in the autumn. Alliance consolidated its position as Northern Ireland's third biggest political party. Lewis Boyle, an 18-year-old A-level student who stood for the party in the Antrim and Newton Abbey Council, became what was thought to be Northern Ireland's youngest elected representative. Colm Eastwood, the leader of the SDLP, said he would not resign despite the party's losses. "If I thought the right course of action was to step down, I would do it in a heartbeat," Colm Eastwood said. The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story and tells us more. Sinn Féin's Vice President Michelle O'Neill has hailed a momentous election result, with her party becoming the largest in council elections in Northern Ireland. As the local government elections count neared its conclusion on Saturday, 20th of May, the Republican Party had 138 elected councillors, with gains achieved across the region. With just a small number of seats outstanding, it means Sinn Féin has replicated its result from last year's Northern Ireland Assembly election, when it became the biggest party at Stormont. Michelle O'Neill used the latest election victory to repeat her call for the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, to return to the power-sharing institution at Stormont. The DUP currently has 120 council seats. The Alliance Party has 65 seats, the Ulster Unionists has 53 seats, and the SDLP has 39 seats, with 33 seats going to others. The Democratic Unionist Party leader, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, insisted that his party had polled strongly, but said unionism needed to learn lessons from the council elections. Sinn Féin secured 30.9% of first preference votes, ahead of the DUP on 23.3%, 13.3% for the Alliance, and 10.9% for the Ulster Unionist Party, and 8.7% for the SDLP. The turnout for the election was 54%. 9 of the 11 council areas have now completed their count.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards the Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. Crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Bogari said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly. The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th Flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes the round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, "The global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces." The Navy commander also said that France claimed that the Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters, not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th Flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels. Thousands have rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip to commemorate the martyrdom of several commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement during the recent Israeli aggression on the coastal territory. The rally also honored those civilians who fell victim to the regime's onslaught earlier this month. The demonstrators vowed to maintain their resistance in the face of the regime's atrocities against Palestinians. In an address to the ralliers, one of the leaders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, Khalid al-Batch, remembered the group's commanders who were assassinated during the five-day Israeli onslaught. Batch said, "We want to tell the whole world that though the F-16 airstrikes and the American 139 rockets were fired toward us, this nation is still alive and will continue the resistance." He said, "We attest our right to freedom. From their blood, we'll continue the resistance. From their death, we received the power to face the Zionists. We will continue." Meanwhile, a similar event was held in the Syrian capital Damascus, where Islamic Jihad Secretary General addressed ralliers. Ziad al-Nakhala hailed the Palestinians' victory against Israel during the regime's recent aggression against Gaza. He said the regime was forced to accept Palestinians' terms for a ceasefire in the face of hundreds of rockets fired into the occupied territories. Nakhala added that Palestinians dealt another hefty blow to Israel's already tarnished image. The official attributed the Palestinian victory to their unity and sacrifices. Nakhala vowed a strong and painful response to any future Israeli assassination of the group's commanders. The recent Israeli aggression on Gaza started on May 9th with the regime launching a devastating campaign of deadly bombings targeting senior commanders of the Islamic Jihad and their families. The Islamic Jihad, in response, fired barrages of rockets toward the occupied territories. The conflict marked the worst episode of fighting between Gaza's resistance factions and the Israeli regime since the 10-day war imposed by Tel Aviv on Gaza in 2021. After 5 days, the two sides agreed to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire that took effect on May the 13th. But flashing back to some of Israeli-Palestinian conflicts since 2000, one would find that the Palestinian resistance has been gaining momentum ever since. Testimony to that claim is that according to figures, from September 2000 to December 2006, over 1,000 rockets were fired into the occupied territories. The rockets were all fired in response to the killing of 80 Palestinians by the Israeli regime. In 2008, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas carried out rocket-fired and mortar attacks against targets across the occupied territories, hitting previously untargeted cities such as Beersheba and Ashdod. That also in response to the killing of plus 1,000 Palestinians. In 2014, the Israeli regime carried out its deadliest aggression on Gaza, killing more than 2,000 Palestinians, including 1,400 civilians according to UN figures. That onslaught also prompted one of the deadliest Palestinian retaliations against Israel, with more than 70 Israelis being killed. All those powerful retaliations bring to the spotlight the power and strength the Palestinian resistance has attained during the past two decades or so, with the Israeli officials admitting that the Islamic Jihad fired 1,000 rockets toward the occupied territories during the recent Israeli-Gaza aggression. It goes without saying that the Palestinian resistance has indeed gained momentum. Maybe that's why resistance movements like Islamic Jihad has come to the understanding that resistance, in fact, is a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime, something that has proven to be the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions.
The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at the Arab League summit, his one-time enemy Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman seen here greeting him. A symbolic moment, sealing Assad's reintegration into the Arab fold after being suspended from the League and isolated by most of the region for over a decade. A man who wanted him dethroned, who supported terrorist groups with the sole aim of toppling him. But now, that is wonder under the bridge. Assad lining up for the League's family photograph. Every handshake, confirmation of his reintegration. One after the other, Arab leaders welcoming Syria's reintegration, and during his own address, Assad repeatedly said that Syria belonged to the Arab world. There have been words of condemnation against Saudi Arabia and the Arab League normalizing ties, rhetoric from the losing end of the so-called Syrian opposition, something that should be shelved in the archives. But there is a new reality taking shape in West Asia. The Arab League Secretary General made sure to relay that message. Saudi Arabia is now a firm believer that security cannot be bought and that countries in this region can establish their own security. The Saudi Foreign Minister, Prince Faisal bin Farham, called for cooperation between Arab countries to achieve security, stability, and economic prosperity. West Asian security, however, does not serve the interests of the U.S. All of these reconciliations with Syria is shunned and rejected by the U.S. The decision to readmit Syria to the Arab League represents a rejection of U.S. interests. The Arab rush to welcome Damascus back into the fold has happened despite public objections from the U.S. U.S. efforts at easing Mr. Assad out and replacing him with an inclusive, democratic government have gone nowhere, leaving American officials on the sidelines. That is one view. However, additionally, U.S. lawmakers are proposing a bill that would prohibit Washington from either recognizing or normalizing relations with any Syrian government led by Assad. The legislation is also a warning to Turkey and Arab countries that if they engage with Assad's government, they could face severe consequences. But who's listening? Challenges do remain. Arab countries are keen to invest in Syria, especially in its reconstruction. But the U.S. legislation builds upon the CSAR Syria Civilian Protection Act, a 2019 law that authorized sanctions on those who do business with the Syrian government. Then there's the issue of Israel, who has continued bombing Syria. How will Arab countries deal with Israel when it comes to Syria? Israel is one of the sorest losers in this, since now there's a stronger united front in the form of an axis of resistance against Israel. On the one hand, the U.S., who is occupying Syrian soil and stealing and selling its oil, is an outsider, accompanied by the Israeli regime, which has no cards left to unify Arab countries against Iran. Nevertheless, China's view on the diminished U.S. role in the region, which closely mirrors Iran's stance, has said it best. Syria's Arab League reintegration, proof that when the U.S. shadow shrinks, peace spreads.
On September 9, 2001, a series of terror attacks targeted the United States. On that morning, a group of terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners. The hijackers crashed the first two planes into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. The third plane succeeded in crashing into the Pentagon, but the fourth one crashed in rural Pennsylvania. The U.S. regime used the incident to launch what it called the Global War on Terror.
They are obsessed with fueling conflict because they profit by the bloodshed, by the turmoil, by the tension, by the diplomatic unease. A lot of money is transferred into the bureaucracies of the military, the intelligence community, the diplomatic community, the military-industrial complex, the war profiteers who make bullets, bombs, tanks, helicopters, guns.
Washington first invaded Afghanistan and then attacked Iraq. A number of other countries were also affected by the wars.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed. 7,000 by the U.S. in the first month of the war, but now hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed by all parties over the 20 years, and that's in part because Iraq descended into civil war shortly after the U.S. invasion. And then, in addition, many millions of people were displaced. Millions of people are still displaced internally and also as refugees in the region.
The military aggressions were devastating for the affected countries and killed countless people. A new research by Brown University's Cost of War Project has now shed light on the human cost of U.S. wars in the region. The report says America's war on terror in war zones of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen killed at least 4.5 to 4.6 million people, though the precise mortality figure remains unknown. The study reviews a wide range of factors contributing to mortality. Those include economic collapse and the resulting loss of livelihood for local residents, the destruction of health infrastructure and public services, environmental contamination, as well as other cultural effects of war that can lead to further violence down the line. Some of these people were killed in the fighting, but far more, especially children, have been killed by the reverberating effects of war, such as spread of disease. The report says these latter indirect deaths are estimated to be around 3.7 million. It says these deaths and related health problems have resulted from the destruction of economies, public services, and the environment in the affected countries. The report has also highlighted the fact that indirect deaths grow in scale over time. The researchers found staggering levels of child malnutrition in some of the affected countries, with Afghanistan and Yemen topping the list. In the wake of Washington's two-decade military occupation, more than 3 million Afghan children are now experiencing wasting, a symptom of severe and potentially life-threatening malnutrition. The U.S. officially ended its war in Afghanistan, but today Afghans are suffering and dying from war-related causes at higher rates than ever. Afghanistan's economy has collapsed, and over half of the population now lives in extreme poverty on less than $1.90 per day. More than 7.6 million children under 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition or wasting in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia. wasting means simply not getting enough food, literally wasting to skin and bones, putting these children at greater risk of death. Diseases such as measles and cholera often sicken malnourished people, particularly children, and at the same time worsen malnutrition.
And then what we also see is that even in the places where the fighting has stopped, civilians and other people, like healthcare workers, have been injured by unexploded ordnance, which has been left in the wake of the war. So the story continues. It's not over. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. And it certainly wasn't cost-free.
Hunger crises are precipitated by war's destruction of economies and the impoverishment of millions in the war zones. Poverty lessens people's abilities to grow and buy food, stay in their home communities, access clean water and sanitation, pay for healthcare and medicine, keep children away from hazardous jobs and other essential pathways to preserving health and life. Explosive remnants of war, including unexploded mines, render land inaccessible to farm and block the transport of goods. Generally, populations displaced by violence face some of the worst levels of food insecurity and malnutrition.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain is now paying the price for its decision to leave the European Union. Guy Hans, British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma, says Britain will soon be poorer than Poland. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg wrote in this regard, Brexit has weakened the UK economy and driven the nation into a sort of geriatric decline. British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma told Bloomberg recently, since the UK left the European Union, it has been competing on the world stage, but the country's current laws are not suitable for the new environment. Billionaire Guy Hens suggested in the outlet's weekly In the Cities podcast, unless change happens, the UK risks becoming poorer compared to other European countries. He said, I look at the UK and see that in 2030, Poland will be wealthier than we are. In 2040, we will be the poor man in Europe. According to Hans, the UK should not have left the EU, as the country needs rule of law and consistency. But not a single politician is talking about going back. He lamented that Brexit has essentially thrown the country back 50 years to the 1970s, a decade that is widely remembered as a time of crisis, with a skyrocketing inflation, high unemployment, strikes and power cuts. The enormous amount of political change that has happened in the UK over the past 7 years has left investors concerned and the public lacking confidence, the billionaires believe. Now that the UK is out of the EU, the British government could take a radical approach and change some of its laws, Hans said, citing the country's extraordinarily complex labour laws that are a nightmare compared to other European countries. The UK also needs some boring bookkeeping, and the current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak seems to be good at it, according to Hans. The financier noted that the British government has succeeded in repairing some of the damage caused by Liz Truss, whose economic policies are absolutely disastrous and would have led to the country needing a bailout. Truss' argument, however, that the UK needed to become much more productive to be more competitive was 100% right. The Atlantic also wrote in this regard, if you walked into a British supermarket this past winter, you were likely to see bare shelves in the salad aisle. Customers might have been limited to purchasing lettuce and tomatoes if there were any lettuce or tomatoes to be found in the first place. Ask the grocers and you'd hear technical explanations for the scarcity, high energy prices, raised costs at British greenhouses. Imports from warmer countries were curtailed by bad weather in southern Europe. Behind all of these situational explanations, however, loomed a larger problem. From the time a tomato is harvested, every minute counts en route to the purchaser's table. In March, British media reported that Britain's departure from the European Union has added 10 to 20 minutes of additional paperwork to every truckload of tomatoes shipped from Spain. Longer if the truckload mixes different produce varieties. 10 to 20 minutes may not sound like much, but multiply that burden by thousands of trucks, squeeze the trucks through the bottleneck of the single underwater tunnel that connects Britain to freight traffic from Europe, and costs and delays accumulate. The result? Winter tomato gluts on the continent, winter tomato shortages in the UK. British consumers are spending less on new clothes and shoes than they did in 2018 and 2019. The British are holding on to their cars longer. The average age of vehicles on British roads have reached 8.7 years on record. The British made about 2 million fewer trips abroad in 2022 than they did in 2018 and 2019, an almost 20% decline. Lingering COVID concerns after a partial explanation, but the UK and most of its European Union neighbours had dropped most travel restrictions in January 2022 and the remainder by March. Altogether, Britain is expected to be the worst performing of the world's 20 biggest economies this year. The British government's official forecaster predicts that after inflation, household incomes will decline by an average of 7.1% over the 3 years ending in spring 2024. On the present trajectory, Britain will not return to 2019 levels of disposable income until 2027. By 2024, the average British household will likely have a lower living standard than the average household in Slovenia. On present trends, the average British household will be poorer than the average in Poland in 2030. Britain is now paying the price for its decision to leave the European Union. Britain voted to exit in the summer of 2016. The departure was formalized on December 31st, 2020. Since then, new barriers of trade, investment and movement have risen between Britain and its nearest neighbours. Investment in Britain has tumbled and the British economy has shrunk. By one authoritative estimate, Britain is 4% poorer today than if it had stayed in the EU. Many in the British government are reluctant to acknowledge this reality. Hugh Peel, the Bank of England's chief economist, lamented in a recent podcast interview. What we are facing now is that reluctance to accept that, yes, we are all worse off. These costs don't necessarily make Brexit a mistake. Brexit was a trade. Less prosperity for more sovereignty. Countries reasonably make such trades all the time. The British were not honestly alerted to the cost of their choice. In 2016, future Prime Minister Boris Johnson campaigned for Brexit in a big red bus carrying a huge printed message, "We sent the EU £350 million on a week." The British war promised that Brexit mean more resources for public and private consumption. Instead, Brexit has predictably turned out to mean less. And the British are surprised, baffled, and of course angry.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April the 18th, 2023.
The Commander of the Faithful, peace be upon him, has said in Nahjul Balagha, "He who neglects the enemy will not be neglected by the enemy." This is letter 62. If you fall asleep in the trench, that does not mean that your enemy has fallen asleep as well. They might be well awake while you are sleeping. So the enemy exists and we cannot deny this. The enemy's strategy is for us to become pessimistic about ourselves. Now, one of the brothers here talked about the issue of hope. It was a good talk, and I don't reject what was said, but I don't agree that despair is mainly due to internal sources. Yes, there are definitely problems inside. We know these problems, but these problems do not dishearten a motivated young student.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A motivated young student becomes disappointed to other things. A professor, or for example, a person who feels no commitment to his or her country, sits and talks with a young person privately. And of course, the same thing also happens in a different way and in a collective broader sense. With what hope are you starting here? Just quit and live. What hope do you have? They tell you who are young and resistant. What hope do you have with this high dollar price and this high inflation rate over the years? What do you have hope in for studying here? This is how despair comes in. This will have an effect. Of course, for a faithful, resistant, knowledgeable, intelligent young person, the response is clear and to the point. Yes, their problems. I'm studying in my country because I intend to live in this country for decades. And my children, my grandchildren, my descendants, and my countrymen will live in this country for hundreds of years. I want to correct the problems. I study to solve the problems. I struggle to solve the problems. This is the young Muslim's response. But that one, the skeptic, does what he or she is doing and negatively affects people. He affects some people. Now, this is one example.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The right to go on strike, to withdraw one's labor over grievances with one's employer. Potentially under threat in proposed legislation that gives the British government sweeping powers to clamp down on industrial action.
They say it's democratic when it's not democratic, so they're an affront to democracy, what they want on this bill. And it'll turn worker, they want to turn worker against worker, but it won't. It'll just cause confusion.
Mr. Speaker.
Formally known as the Minimum Service Level Bill, voted on in Parliament Monday, the legislation enables the government to determine what a minimum level of service should be, with potential consequences for strikers and the unions that represent them.
The unions would face sequestration of their funds, which is obviously a serious, very serious step, and unions can't afford to go down that road. So it will effectively stop strike action in those parts of the economy, but it will also seek to scare people in other parts of the economy about what will happen to them should they take the decision to go on strike.
The freedom to form and join a union and to bargain collectively is one of the four international labor standards, standards which the UK government has signed up to.
The UK is part of the ILO and signed up to all of its conventions. So the right to strike is really, as I said, fundamental human right. It's something that we should protect and be very aware of any legislation that seeks to restrict that. And I think, you know, I think internationally people will be concerned that here in the UK we're seeking to restrict that right.
Among the sectors impacted by the legislation, health, education, transport and fire services, all of which have staged several rounds of industrial action over pay and working conditions over the past year, in the face of the UK's cost of living crisis.
Strikes became common during the Industrial Revolution. The UK has recognized the right to strike since at least 1906. And the protesters and union leaders here say they're not going to allow that right to be eroded or taken away. Saeed Pereza, London.
It's
Specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Если раньше